All right, folks, welcome back to another edition of The Realist Report. This is your host, John Friend. The website is therealistreport.com, where you can find an extensive archive of these podcasts, as well as other radio broadcasts I have participated in the past. You can also find all of my blog posts and articles, a contact page, my Twitter feed, which is embedded on the right-hand side of the website, and many other useful and important links. I am a regular reporter for American Free Press, America's last real newspaper, and I also contribute to the Barnes Review, the bi-monthly history magazine affiliated with American Free Press. I encourage everyone listening to subscribe to both publications. Check out AmericanFreePress.net and BarnesReview.org for more details. Okay, with that said, let me introduce my special guest this evening. Carolyn Yeager is back once again to discuss a recent debate between Andrew Anglin and Greg Johnson, which focused on the importance and relevance of historical revisionism in the overall pro-white struggle, a topic Carolyn and I have addressed in the past. Carolyn, welcome back to the program. How are you this evening?
I'm just fine, John. Glad to be here.
Yes, good. I'm glad that you could join me. You wrote an article about this debate between Greg Johnson and Andrew Anglin, which is over on CarolynYeager.net, and I will link to it. I hope people go over there and check it out. I think you have a lot of very important and good things to say about the debate. And really, that's going to be the main topic for this conversation. I'll be honest, I did not listen to the entire debate. I think you can find it on YouTube, and you can also find it on, there's like a new alternative to YouTube from what I understand called, I think it's BitChute, is that correct?
Yes.
Yeah, so you can find it multiple places. You have it linked a couple different
Yeah, I have both of them linked too.
Yeah, over on your site. And if you just Google it, you can find it. It's been all over the place. It was a pretty, a pretty interesting debate, certainly worth checking out. Again, I didn't listen to the entire thing. I listened to most of it. And I mean, frankly, I've basically heard what both Anglin and Johnson have to say about the subject. So it really wasn't anything.
Yeah. And then Anglin said afterwards that, it wasn't supposed to be a debate, but then afterwards they started calling it a debate. But I guess that was important to him, that he didn't feel like he was in a debate. You know, he wasn't prepared maybe to debate anything, you know, but interestingly, they did have, pretty much opposing views when it came to Holocaust, which is and revisionism, which is the part that I found interesting.
Right. Now, there was another debate that preceded the Anglin and Johnson debate, and that was between Greg Johnson and Vox Day. And they did a debate, and it was hosted by Tara McCarthy, who also hosted the debate between Anglin and Johnson. And the Johnson and Vox Day debate, was a few weeks ago, I want to say shortly after Charlottesville. And they were kind of addressing similar topics. They were talking about National Socialists and Nazis and how important or relevant they are, like in the pro-white, alt-right movement or whatever. And I listened to that too. I didn't listen to the entire thing, but I thought that was kind of interesting. And again, I've heard the arguments made by Johnson and Vox Day. So it wasn't really anything.
Yeah, I had not before, but they were sort of focused on socialism, you know, in that debate, you know, National Socialism and what socialism meant and how to interpret it and so on. And I listened to it because you mentioned it to me, but I didn't think much of it.
Yeah, you know, I really didn't either. And even the Anglin and Johnson debate, I really wasn't that impressed with either of them. So I mean, I agreed more with Anglin, but I think I would basically just present the information and present my perspective much differently than even Anglin would. I would explain it much differently and make different points than he would, than he did in this debate. Although I think he did, I think he did okay. But I think I would have just handled it much differently. So I think overall I would,
agree with Anglin. The reason they had that, according to Anglin, and it's true, was that Anglin complained that Greg Johnson had misrepresented him in the Vox Day debate. And so they said, well, you come on, and we'll talk about that. And so in a couple of places, that's when, Johnson asked Andrew, well, how did I misrepresent you, Andrew? And Andrew told him he was prepared to say that. He had a couple of different things that he thought were important. But then I don't think Anglin had thought he was prepared to debate the Holocaust or Adolf Hitler or anything like that. So he didn't, that's why he said what he did, because maybe he would have done a different job if he had gone there intending to debate that, but
okay,
he just said
gotcha.
What he thought, you know, and,
sure.
And I thought he did okay, but you're right. He didn't have some things right.
Yeah, no, I think overall he did pretty good. And again, I would certainly agree with Anglin over Greg Johnson for sure when it comes to this issue. So with that being said, I just want to say really quickly about Greg Johnson, because I think you're going to be much more critical of him than I will be. I've been listening to and reading Greg Johnson for a number of years. I have one of his books, and I'm forgetting the title off the top of my head. New Right versus Old Right, I think that's the name of it.
Yeah.
Yeah, and the book is, I think Greg Johnson is a very, very smart man. He's very articulate. I think he makes a lot of good arguments. His book I thought was really good, although there were certain sections that I totally disagreed with, including the article where he talks about the Holocaust and how, and it was actually the article that was published originally on the OccidentalObserver.net, if I'm not mistaken. It was basically the same article he wrote for the website that was also published in the book. And that's an article that I'm sure we'll bring up and talk about here as we proceed. But the book overall was very good. I learned a lot from it. I think he makes a very good case for, you know, pro-white interests overall. I think he's very articulate, very intelligent. I mean, the man's a PhD. He's obviously, you know, very smart. I just totally disagree with him when it comes to revisionism and the Holocaust. So I just want to say that, you know, I think he's very smart. I think he is an asset to the movement overall. I just disagree with him. And of course there's also this debate whether or not he's gay, and I don't know if he is or not. I frankly
don't really
care.
Well, that's definitely, John, that's a definite fact. I mean, he didn't want to talk about it for a long time, tried to avoid it and not talk about it, but he never denied it. And, it was Alex Linder who was trying to get him to deny it, and he didn't do it. He's always walking around it. So he prides himself in being able to swerve around and make his arguments and come out what he thinks is, you know, with the winning argument. No matter what, it's not based really on that he's got all the facts right or the facts on his side, but he just thinks he knows how to argue. And he said that, you know, so, I think that there's no doubt about that. He doesn't want to say so, but he doesn't fight it.
Right. And you know, honestly, I think you're probably right. But again, it's not something that I frankly care too much about. I mean,
yeah, well,
you know, it is what
Johnson,
it is.
Let me say that I don't care too much about him. I could leave him alone. But I do care about, as you know, revisionism, and I care about World War II history, and I care about National Socialism. And when I hear him saying the things he does, I can't, and I don't think we should, just say, well, that's his opinion. He can have his opinion. Naturally, he can have his opinion, but I wouldn't just let it pass it by and say it doesn't matter. He's good on other things. I think it does matter because, as I'm going to try to point out here, the things that he says about it are totally ridiculous and
sure.
wrong and uneducated,
sure.
you know.
Yeah, I agree with
he
you.
He makes
and
this
I...
great argument. You're right. He makes this argument that just, you know, slips around. But it's not based on facts, and it's not, therefore, it shouldn't be respected, I don't think.
Okay. Yeah, I sort of agree with you. I mean, pretty much. You know, but before we get into the main topic, let's actually just address this right off the bat, this issue
Good.
Of Johnson being gay. Cause I've heard you argue and you argue in the article you wrote that his homosexuality seems to influence his thinking and his you know, pro-white stance and everything. So how influential is, you know, his homosexual identity in all of this? Do you think it has a huge role in his overall perspective?
Yeah. Well, I said so. And, you know, I realized when I was writing this that I was just being way out there with, giving the reasons for his thinking as his homosexuality over and over again. I knew I was doing that, and I didn't actually get criticized for it, but I thought I would, but then I thought it just hits me so hard in everything that he says. When I kept to the Holocaust revisionism for the most part, and somewhat with the Hitler stuff, you know, it just strikes me so strongly that is the reasoning behind it. And this is not brand new, because I've said these things before, but I haven't talked about Greg Johnson for a long time. And I don't think, in a sense, it's none of my business what Greg Johnson is doing. But when he comes out publicly with this stuff on this topic, I just feel like, you know, I gotta answer this, and I've gotta say something. And there are some people who appreciate it.
No, definitely. So. I mean, every time I hear him or Dr. Kevin MacDonald, again, two individuals I've learned a lot from, I respect. I think they're, you know, certainly on our side overall, but I just totally disagree with this. And I think it is a very important point. In fact, I mean, as you know, I often argue, you know, when I'm doing podcasts, when I'm writing, that the fake Holocaust story is the entire bedrock of this new world order, this anti-white genocide agenda, you know, Jewish agenda. This is the heart of it. This is what drives it all. It's the, mm-hmm. you know, the paradigm that really shapes this and advances this. And I mean, I just don't see how we could avoid it if we are to confront these problems and deal with them seriously. I don't think that we can. And we'll get into that, you know, as we proceed.
Yeah, I know you believe that, John, but you're also, you're a very nice person, but also you are committed to the movement. You don't want to criticize people. And I'm criticized for going out and criticizing people who some people think shouldn't be criticized, like especially Kevin MacDonald. And, you know, a couple weeks before this Johnson-Anglin thing discussion, I wrote something about Kevin MacDonald, which was longer than this. He did a radio program with that non-Jewish Jew. A girl there was asked him about Holocaust and Hitler and stuff. And so he answered, and I was so shocked, or, you know, I just thought his answers were pretty terrible. So I wanted to, and I wrote about him 2 years ago on the same topic, but because of a radio program he did. So these two men, now MacDonald, I always respected so much, and I would never have, he never talked about it that I knew of in the past, you know, but he did on these two occasions because he was asked. And these were both, maybe since he was retired. I don't know if he was retired the first one, but probably. And I thought, well, that's pretty ignorant, you know, that's not right. And so I made a noise about it. I'm good at doing that. I don't.
Yes,
so,
you are.
You know, that's my role, I guess. But so I have those two that kind of go together in my mind. So when this came up with Greg Johnson, I thought, well, I'm going to write something about this too, just to be fair, you know?
Sure. Yeah. And I mean, I think it's totally legitimate to have these discussions and to publicly, you know, disagree with other thought leaders in the alt-right or whatever. I think that's totally fine. I think that's healthy and really what we should be doing, rather than, you know, kind of engaging in drama or gossip and all this other crap. If we're gonna criticize
or just
somebody,
ignoring it. I mean, mostly people don't want to criticize someone like Kevin MacDonald, even over his views on Holocaust revisionism. But it was a big hit, that a lot of conversation about it.
Yeah.
A lot of comments, a good thread about it, and so on. So
right. Yeah, no, I agree.
But, you know, like you, that's my big thing. And I've decided even more and more that when it comes down to it, that's my big thing. And so I'm going to push it as much as I can. And I don't have the reach those guys do, but I can certainly say what I think about what the misleading things they're saying about it.
Yes, exactly. Me too. So let's get right into it. What were your overall thoughts on the debate? What points would you make?
What points would I make? As it came out, Johnson said, no honest revisionist claims that the Holocaust never happened. Anyway, he said that Robert Faurisson questions the Holocaust based on a particular definition. He said, Robert Faurisson claims that the Holocaust never happened, but only by insisting, okay, on a particular definition. That is his, those are his words. He says, his argument is too clever by half and cannot be taken seriously. Now, this might be in the article he wrote afterwards about it. What I have on my website about this, I came down from there. He kept repeating, I don't think we have to rehabilitate Third Reich. He kept saying that, you can say that we're Nazis, or you can say, no, we're not Nazis, or you can say Nazis are not evil, but you can't say that,
Well, his main argument seemed to be that the pro-white struggle and you know, having a pro-white identity and, you know, just the overall pro-white message is in no way related to what happened during World War II.
Right.
That was his main thing.
Thanks for helping me out.
And theoretically, what he's saying is true. I mean, the fact that white people deserve their own countries, that there's this very blatant anti-white agenda, you know, that's being advanced on every single white country. You know, we're being forced with, you know, all this mass immigration, forced multiculturalism, forced integration, all this anti-white propaganda, etc. You know, this is wrong, and our cause is totally legitimate, and it is in no way related to or tied to World War II. That's correct in theory, but that's not the way it works in the real world, right? Anytime.
Yeah, and everybody's familiar with that. You know, that's just a bunch of baloney, saying that. That's fine for us to say, but nobody pays attention to it, as you just said, in the real world, you know. So he kept saying, well, we can make this wonderful argument, you know, that, this is absurd what they're saying, to say that what they call white supremacists or just white identists or people in white activists are Nazis. That's just so absurd, you know, on his face. That's silly. And that's not a good argument.
And it is.
Well, we can just ignore that, you know, and just go on and do our thing, whatever. He doesn't really have an answer to it. But his whole answer to all of it is to ignore it. And what he called in his article he wrote quite a number of years ago that caused such a stir was he was using that phrase to step over it. So we just step over the Holocaust and go on our way, you know, and say this doesn't have anything to do with us.
Right. But there's no way to, I mean, theoretically you could if you're talking about it, again, from a theoretical perspective.
You know, Andrew Anglin countered that on that show by saying, if we say we agree with everything Hitler said and did, which he does, you know, basically, expects that people are going to do. If we agree with what Hitler did, we can't then say, well, we have nothing to do with him. And we, you know, he said that doesn't, nobody's going to fall for that. Nobody's going to go along with that. And Greg is saying, well, he wouldn't say that. That then leads him to, get us away from Adolf Hitler's National Socialism too, which he disagrees with. And that's part of what is New Right is about, right?
And from what I remember about the book, his main critique of the old right is that it was kind of brutal and violent and tyrannical. And I think that's a totally distorted view of National Socialism.
Well, it is, but see, now that's where the homosexuality comes in. You know, that absolutely comes in there. He doesn't like what he doesn't, he used to be kind of much more friendly toward Hitler and National Socialism, but he's moved away from that because he sees or just decided or whatever that, this is over a number, quite a number of years, that, this is a government that could, treat his group badly. And now he doesn't, and, you know, so therefore he rejects anything to do with fascism, you know, what would be called fascism, the Third Reich. He rejects it. And it's and to me, it's because he's afraid of the brutality. He's afraid of the harshness. He doesn't think, that he could, convince them that he's a good guy and they should leave him and all his friends alone. So
it's almost as if he knows that he would be sort of excluded, you know, in a national socialist type state because he is homosexual.
Mm-hmm.
And that's kind of what motivates him. And that seemed to be kind of the argument you were making in your article. And it's, yeah, I mean, it's entirely valid. I mean, it certainly does seem to be sort of the case.
Well, and I think that, Greg has been so successful financially. He takes in a lot of money from the way I think and the way you think, I'm pretty sure, as to how much money you get, have ever gotten. He gets a lot of money. I think he gets a lot from the homosexual community because even though he was criticized for being homosexual and he wouldn't admit to any of it, he published books by out blatant homosexuals like, James O'Meara, who has been exposed on the internet, cross-dressing and doing a lot of weird things, pictures and everything. And Jack Donovan. And he's been very friendly, he was very friendly with him. And I think he has a lot of writers, although I was looking at his site more recently, which I hadn't for a long time. And he's got a lot of different people writing articles here. I don't know who they all are, but he had a lot of writers that I think, just from the sound of them, the way they wrote and what they wrote about that I suspected they were homosexual too. Now, you know, your commenter Tucker thinks that I, see homosexuals everywhere, but, I guess I may have a sensitivity to them because, when I think that they are, I notice it. And so I just have, in my opinion, he depends a lot on the homosexual community. And they for money, and they send him a lot of money because he stands up and he publishes their work and so on. And he also, I don't know so much now, but back when I was making a study of it, I noticed and pointed out that he had constantly photographs, you know, he has a picture with every little post announcement on his site, way outnumbered photographs of men, with a lot of muscles showing and not wearing very much, you know, and old, classic pictures, classic paintings and sculptures and so on, which make, you know, he supposedly deals with the classics, but they had all these, the kind of men, the kind of pictures that homosexuals would like looking at, you know, would really love looking at. And, so the whole thing just all fits together when he would say something like, let me find something that he actually said. Naturally, now I don't see anything right off the bat. He says, but it's foolish for us to attack the enemy at their best defended points. We're into revisionism. Because we can make a case for white identity and white interests that doesn't depend on whether or not the Nazis got it right or wrong. Things like
I think he's so wrong about that because anytime you make a pro-white case, it's inevitably going to be tied into Hitler, the Nazis, and the Holocaust. I mean, the Jews have been so successful with this fake story, it's totally discredited any form of white identity, and they've pathologized it. And it's instantly tied in with this.
Yeah, And that's why he wants to distance himself from National Socialism and Hitler as much as possible. And he thinks, you know, he says that that will work. But then he also said in this podcast, there are many things I think the National Socialists did wrong. And I do think that their plans for the Slavic East were really genocidal. Then he said that Plan Ost, which is in on the famous Wikipedia page, was a fabrication, as far as he can tell. But he still considers the Holocaust a genocide, and, you know, against Jews. And now what really gets me, and because we don't have forever, I'm going to jump to it. In his article on his website that he wrote about the debate, he said a few interesting things. And then this Ehrman, what's his first name? Vince Ehrman or something, who he published his book, who wrote a book about Hitler, kind of a friendly book about Hitler, and Greg's company published it. He wrote a comment and said that he thought Anglin was right, and that and that's where he said Anglin was doing the right thing by making fun of the Holocaust and so on. And in reply, Greg wrote a little reply to him, and he said, the Holocaust is a great big pile of dead Jews, not a normative claim that Jewish suffering is more important than non-Jewish suffering. Sorry, I left out that this Ehrman said that the whole meaning of the Holocaust is not genocide, but that it's the claim of Jews that their suffering during World War II was vastly more significant than any other suffering in history. A very good point, which you would agree with, I'm sure, that's really what it's all about. They're so jealous of anybody else having any claims to having any, you know, then that will come up when we talk about, the polls and the polls demands now for reparations, if we get a chance to do that. Anyway, Greg answered that, the Holocaust is a great big pile of dead Jews, not a normative claim that Jewish suffering is more important than non-Jewish suffering. You can drop that moral absurdity, everything he wants to call it that way, but there's still a great big pile of dead Jews. Well,
but is there really? Karen?
No,
is there? No, there's no. Not exactly. Yeah,
I mean, and what is a pile of? The Holocaust has to be more than a pile of dead Jews. There's piles of dead people of all kinds.
There's
everywhere.
Exactly. There's photos of piles of dead bodies that are presented to a very gullible and traumatized public. And we're told, oh, hey, look how evil the Nazis are. Look at all these dead people that you know, died in these concentration camps. It's never explained, you know, how these people died, what happened, you know, what was going on at the time. There's no context. It's all very emotional and psychologically exploitative propaganda that is designed to instill and reinforce this fake narrative.
Right. And then here's where I want to make the point that I was made in the wrong place before, that he said that Andrew's position in this article, he said this, Andrew's position on the Holocaust boils down to it never happened, but it should have. And he says, this is completely indefensible. And I ask, what is it? You know, because I'm saying, my point I'm going to make here is that you need to define what the Holocaust is. And that's why saying it's a big pile of dead Jews doesn't cut it. And, then Greg writes, first, to say it never happened is factually indefensible. No honest revisionist claims that the Holocaust never happened. And then he says Robert Faurisson does claim this, but only by insisting on a particular definition. His argument is too clever by half. The pot calling the kettle black, and cannot be taken seriously. Even if one grants every serious revisionist argument, what remains is Holocaust enough for most people. Now, this is just coming from that 2012, I think it was, long article he titled Dealing with the Holocaust that he published at Occidental Observer. And MacDonald, turns out, was totally in agreement with him and ends up coming out later with the very same arguments. And then You know, the thing is that Farisan is right. You have to have a definition for what you're talking about. What is the Holocaust? You can't talk about the Holocaust and then everybody talking about it has a different idea what it is. And it's just a big pile of dead Jews, according to this very smart PhD, John, who you said is such a smart man.
No, I hear you. By the way, you're referring to an article, and I've not read this article. I just found it on counter-currents.com. My conversation with Andrew Anglin.
Right, right. Yeah, I've got a link to it here.
I'll link to that in this blog post so people can go read what he had to say. About, and it's kind of, it looks like it's kind of his summary or concluding thoughts on the debate with Anglin. Yeah, you know, one thing I wanted to ask you is, and Greg Johnson brought this up in the debate, you know, it's always like people, even him, he's obviously not like an outright like national socialist, you know, he loves Hitler, et cetera. But, you know, he tries to be objective and fair and say, oh, well, the Nazis weren't that bad, but they did do some things wrong. Carolyn, what exactly did Hitler and the Nazis do wrong? I'm trying to figure that out.
See, I don't agree with that. He comes up with, he mentions, I have to keep jumping around on my notes here, but he mentions that, Operation Oster, whatever it was called, they found some notes about it, you know, there was a plan, but they made all kinds of plans. That different people wrote out plans for the Eastern, you know, for the East when they took more control of it and so on. That doesn't mean they are ever carried out or they were going to be quite in that way. And so there's a whole lot made out of that. But then he admits that it's a fabrication. But he thinks that, that still, he always says that, that the Nazis did things wrong. He said it in both the debate and in his article. But he never can really point out to what it is. But he thinks that they did exterminate Jews, which now for him, then that's immoral. He doesn't say, you know, he's supposed to be anti-Jew, but that's immoral. Well, you know, others, revisionists say they didn't exterminate Jews and there was never a plan. Now, this brings us to the definition of the Holocaust, which you're very aware of and a lot of people are, but let's just go over it real quick. As Michael Shermer wrote in 2000, he's a Jewish Holocaust apologist. He says, when historians talk about the Holocaust, what they mean is that about 6 million Jews were killed in an intentional and systematic fashion by the Nazis using a number of different means, including gas chambers. And then Michael Barenbaum and Deborah Lipstadt said the same thing. And so have many, many others. And that's known to be what they insist on. The Jews themselves insist on that for the Holocaust. They don't let you change that, take away from the 6 million or say that there was no plan or intention to kill the Jews. And Deborah Lipstadt says they intended to kill every Jew in Europe and, things like that. You know, she has they have no evidence for that, and that's why someone like Greg Johnson doesn't want to bring that up because he knows it can be debunked. But at the same time, he wants to say that there was a Holocaust and the Nazis were responsible for it. And that's why, we don't want to be, associated with them or call ourselves Nazis. That is not the reason. That's all.
Yeah. And you know that, and again, that's what's so bizarre to me with how a guy like Greg Johnson, this very smart man, academic, PhD, Kevin MacDonald, same thing, Richard Spencer as well. He's kind of always kind of poo-pooed revisionism and doesn't think it's important and relevant, at least from I've heard from him in the past and conversations I've had with
him. They all do the same thing.
Yeah, they all think it's, you know, we can step over it. We don't have to address it. We can ignore it. It's not relevant or related to our current
And, you know,
struggle.
I also think, and I don't want to, you know, make a fuss here, but, you know, I also think that Richard Spencer is basically homosexual. And I think there's a problem with, now, of course, Kevin isn't, but, I think there's a problem with having so many homosexuals, in the white movement and as leaders, you know, I think there's a problem with that personally. So I just thought I'd bring that up because it comes up.
It always does. And to my knowledge, Richard Spencer is not a homosexual. That's all I'll say about it. I don't think that he is. I think he's, from what I understand, he is married and he has a child and everything.
Yeah.
Anyways, my point is that these guys, right. Yeah. Anyways, my point is that these guys, these very smart guys, always dismiss revisionism and don't think it's important. But what's bizarre to me is that revisionism itself is very, very well founded from a scholarly perspective, from an academic perspective. I mean, all of the books that have been written debunking, scientifically debunking the Holocaust in virtually every single regard, every single aspect of the official Holocaust narrative is not true. I mean, I can confidently say that at this point. None of it is true. It's all propaganda. It's all, you know, just this fake
narrative.
And these
guys avoid that. They don't talk about it.
Exactly.
They don't talk about it at all. And then they just say that, well, I'm not convinced that it didn't happen. What kind of thing? They don't let themselves be convinced. They won't read anything.
Well, and Johnson even argued in the debate that it's like over the head of most people and it's too difficult to go through all this information. And it's like, no, it's not. I mean, if you just stop and think about it and break it down, you know, as you were kind of explaining, like the basic tenets of the official Holocaust narrative are 6 million Jews. It was done in gas chambers largely, and it was a systematic, coordinated plan carried out by Hitler and the Nazis. All three of those assertions are easily proven to be false. Mm-hmm. So what I don't understand is, it's clear to me that they just are afraid of this topic. They're avoiding it because they think it's bad PR. I think that's really what it boils down to.
Here, I would used to say that, but now I go further and, I'm pretty convinced that, they don't like Nazism. They don't like Hitler. And I've given my reasons for why Greg doesn't, but Kevin doesn't, because he's just never has, you know. He likes Americanism. He thinks we need to be American. He doesn't want to go there.
It's too taboo,
I think.
For McDonald's.
I think with Kevin, he personally doesn't like anything to do with Nazis. It personally turns him off. He doesn't like uniforms. He doesn't like the swastika. He doesn't like, any of the way they behaved or anything. I mean, he really sincerely doesn't like it, but that means he's not looking at it as he supposedly looks at history, you know, in an honest, objective manner. He's looking at it from want us to get involved with that. And so that's why they don't want to reconstruct or revisit the Holocaust, because if the Holocaust didn't happen, then Hitler might be rehabilitated. And that's the one thing they don't want. They want Hitler to be the bad guy. You see, and some of us don't want that. And so we're really at odds here. And
I've seen that more clearly.
And I don't think, you know, I can't just ignore that and say, oh, well, that's okay. I still support you. Because to me, what they're doing is keeping us in this bondage to the Jews, and they're helping the Jews. They don't want to help the Jews, but they think that this won't, you know, they think they can ignore the Holocaust and National Socialist, the Third Reich, and move ahead with white identity and it won't hurt anything. But all of them are much more tolerant of Jews as friends and in the movement than I would be. I mean, they're talking now. Richard Spencer was talking in that video I linked to, in that comment I wrote, that he thinks mixed race people can be in the white movement, and if they're mostly white, they can certainly, you know, adjust if they really are for us, that we can just accept all these people. See, that's too lax for me.
Yeah, no, I hear you. And by the way, the comments that you're referring to, and you mentioned Tucker, who was a commenter on my website, this is from our last podcast. So if you go back in the archives, you find the most recent conversation I had with you. You can find all the comments there and kind of see what we're talking about.
Yeah.
But no, yeah, I mean, to me, it just doesn't make any sense how these obviously very, very smart, you know, educated men, you know, just dismiss all of this scholarly research done into the Holocaust by guys like Garmar Rudolph, for example, who is himself a scientist and a PhD, Robert Forson, and I mean, many others, countless others. I mean, check out mm-hmm. thebarnesreview.org for all of like the most classic Holocaust revisionist books. They're all for sale. They're all very worth purchasing and reading, in my opinion. I mean, we've proven that the story is not true. We've proven it scientifically. We've proven it from a very scholarly perspective. It's really, in my view, not up for debate anymore. So, I mean, it's just a matter of these guys not taking the time to do the research or just choosing to ignore this and downplay it. And you can't. I mean, it's very clear that you can't.
They don't want that to be a part of their movement. And they're dishonest about it. They won't argue it. You know, they won't talk. They won't say, okay, I think this is wrong and this is why. And they won't argue those points. They don't want to get into it because they don't think they have a very good argument. So they just avoid it. And that I think is dishonest and it's not fair. Now I came across something else at Countercurrents. Just yesterday, probably, written by Kevin McDonald in 2016, September, one year ago, posted there, titled The Alt-Right and the Jews. And, you know, most of it was just the usual thing that Kevin talks about with the Jewish influence and how it grew in our societies and so on. But then he got into a little more specific things, and he said, which others have said, I think it's fine that some organizations and alt-right figures do not discuss Jewish issues. Well, that's okay. But then a few sentences later, he said, I would love it if there could be an alt-right mass movement with significant Jewish support. And then he gives some reasons why that's probably not going to happen and, you know, why it might not work out so well. But it shows that, you know, that's just a different attitude. That he would like to see
it's almost
Jewish support.
It's incredible. I mean, it's almost it's a naive attitude to think that, oh, maybe Jews will finally be objective like us and realize that our message is legitimate and righteous and honest. No, the Jews are never going to admit this. At least not in large numbers. There might be a couple individual Jews who would maybe support, you know, the idea of a white ethno state or, you know, sort of go along with our perspective. But overall, the Jews have made very clear as a collective racial entity that they are very, very and blatantly hostile to our interests and hostile to the future prospects of our race and, in fact, are doing everything in their power to bring about our destruction. And they make this very clear. So to me, it's very naive. I don't understand it. Like, just one day, oh, we're going to finally convince the Jews.
Well, and if they want to have some Jews who they think would see it, and here's what he said, you know, that the Jews would see it in their interest, that white societies continue to be healthy because that's in the Jews' interest as they live there, you know, and they don't want them to deteriorate into all these minorities, factions and so on. Then he's still talking about Jewish interests. So Jews are doing it because it's best for them, not because it's in the interests of white people, not because they identify as white, but only that they want to live in white countries and, get along all right for themselves. So that's a totally different thing. And like, yes, it's very naive and, it's very much academic, I guess. You know, you praise these guys because they're PhDs and then, but this is an attitude that more academics tend to have. You know, I still respect Kevin McDonald a great deal. I mean, I've always liked him, but I just think that, this needs to be said and I'd actually hope that more people would, look at all this and you know, make comments about it and say, think about it. Because
sure.
I think it's very harmful to what we're trying to do.
I'll just say publicly, I mean, I don't know if Kevin McDonald or Greg Johnson or Richard Spencer would even listen to this, but if they do and they're interested in discussing this with me, I'd be more than happy to have them on. And, you know, I'm sure most people listening, I'm not like this very hostile interviewer. You know, I want to hear them out, and I'd probably challenge them, obviously.
Well, I don't think they would. I really sincerely doubt very much that they don't want to have to explain themselves. That's why they do it the way they do.
Well, and all I would say is, you know, to a guy like Kevin McDonald or Greg Johnson or Spencer, anybody else who, you know, kind of goes along with their line of thinking that we can avoid this issue and we can step over it, as Johnson argued. If you really do think that, I mean, that's fine, I guess. I mean, I would just say don't, to use an alt-right expression, don't counter-signal revisionists and people that are, you know, critically investigating the fake Holocaust narrative. There's no need to. If you're not interested in this topic, if you don't think it's important, then simply avoid it. But don't accept the mainstream Jewish narrative in any way. Just say, hey, look, it's got nothing to do with what I'm saying. You know, white people have rights that, you know, my pro-white ideas and views have nothing to do with Hitler or Nazis or the Holocaust. I don't care about it. You know, that happened 70, 80 years ago. What I'm talking about is now. That's all they have to do.
Right.
They don't have to go along with the fake story. They don't have to say, oh, well, you know, Hitler did do some things wrong and, you know, Jews were persecuted and murdered. No, just avoid it altogether. That to me is the best approach to take if you are going to, you know, go along with Johnson and McDonald and Spencer and these other guys.
Well, right. And I said that in that article about McDonald in his podcast. It'd be okay with me if he just said, I don't know anything about it. I haven't studied it. I don't like to talk about it because I have not studied the issues. And then that would be it. But instead, he did give some opinions and then he made the silly comment that I've never seen anything that convinced me. Well, that's just a dumb comment.
He's not looking very hard then.
No.
Because, I mean, I could, no. I mean, Dr. McDonald, I'll send you, you know, multiple books, you know, multiple links. I mean, you can find this all out on the internet. And see, that was another thing I wanted to bring up is Johnson kept arguing that, you know, to get our message across to people, you know, in a modern context, we don't need to rehabilitate Hitler or the Third Reich or National Socialism or anything like that. And I mean, I would disagree with that. I think that from an objective, you know, truth-seeking perspective, it's very clear that Hitler was a very righteous and honorable man. He was the greatest political, you know, statesman in modern Western history. I think you could say that and argue that very, very convincingly. You know, from a very objective, scholarly perspective.
Yeah, and but you'd have to have all your facts and figures at hand.
Well, that's not easy, but
you could.
Yeah.
Of course you could.
That's true. And also, I think
but
that
he still, Johnson says that not because he knows that or anything, but he says that because he doesn't want it. He doesn't want it to be rehabilitated because he doesn't want it. He doesn't want it to return, you know?
Yeah.
And that way, that's exactly what the Jews don't want. The Jews don't want, they don't want Hitler to be rehabilitated more than they care about the Holocaust. The Holocaust is very important to them. But they don't want Hitler to return or anything like that, you know? So they're in accord with that. And that's why they want to keep the Holocaust in place. So they can say, look, you know, he's responsible for this, and we can't have him. He was a bad guy.
Right, exactly, yeah.
And so I just say, you know, they're not coming from an honest place. They're not coming from an honest, scholarly place. And in truth, the whole thing is that nobody is going to. Everybody comes from what they want to happen, what they, you know, and it's all about power. when you come down to it, you know, history is all who's in power, and it's not what's true. You can find a lot, you can find a lot about truth and what's true, and you have different opinions, but if you, but in the overall, you know, it's who's in power, and that's what it's going to be. So you have to change the power. And so someone like, say, Andrew Anglin and his way of, dealing with that, I'm not saying he does it, the best, but his way, that way of dealing with it is in the end, it's necessary. Because we could, we agree, but we could talk with other people till we're blue in the face. And if they don't want to change, the way the general views of life, the views of modern life are, they're not going to go along with it.
Right. Well, really, it's all about who controls the narrative, and the Jews have controlled the narrative when it comes to pretty much every major issue of importance, you know, all of the issues that really form our paradigms for how we understand the world, how we understand our history. It's all a Jewish narrative. It's a Jewish-approved narrative that advances Jewish interests and delegitimizes white interests. I mean, that's what it's all about, is it's about controlling the narrative. And what's sad to me is that we've made so much progress in countering that Jewish narrative, that weaponized Jewish narrative, certainly within the past, I mean, since I've been involved in this movement anyways. I mean, think about Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told.
Right.
What a brilliant film. That, mm-hmm. that is very, you know, very professionally done, very, very powerful, very, very moving. A great film, and it's huge on YouTube. I mean, it's been censored countless times, but I would venture to say that literally millions of people have seen that, and it has profoundly impacted them. It certainly did for me. And, you know, there's many other documentaries, many other books that have been written, many other podcasts. I mean, you've done a lot of work on this. I think you've played a huge role in rehabilitating the image of Hitler and Nazis and the World War II narrative in general, and other people have as well.
Thank you.
And this work is so important, and we've made a lot of progress. We really have.
So mm-hmm. You're right. There's, you know, I mean, that's why we got to keep pushing. We've got to keep pushing it. I'm convinced of that now. If I do anything, I'm going to just keep working on Holocaust revisionism. And also what I can do with Hitler, but mostly with this revisionism, because there is so much. I mean, it's all been figured out. It's all been debunked. You know, it's just a matter of getting people to pay attention. You know, I was talking to you about my nephew, and you know what I noticed with him? He's very open-minded. He's, you know, very non-judgmental, willing to look at things, but he doesn't care all that much. You know, I can tell. You know, I send him some things to read and look at, and he did. And then he said, well, there's, what about this and that? And, you know, he wasn't completely convinced by it. Like when I came to it, I was like ready to be convinced. You know, I mean, I wanted to be convinced. I admit that. I wanted it to be, not be true. Other people want it to be. And so it was different, but he's kind of like just, he's more interested in the Constitution and things like that, you know, so I'm not going to press it, but I did send him the book debating the Holocaust, and, he said he would read it, but you know, you can't force this down people if they're not really, it's not really what they think is most important. So they, even if he would be, you know, convinced to some degree, which would at least be nice. It doesn't mean he'd become like me, you know?
And that's, I mean, that's how the vast majority of people are. And mm-hmm. that's why controlling the narrative, controlling how information is presented, whether it's through the media, whether it's through our educational establishment, it's so important. And the Jews have a total stranglehold over this, at least in the official channels. I think we're chipping away at that and sort of eroding that, you know, is certainly within the past 10 years or so. But that's really what it's all about, is most people don't care about World War II. They don't care about the Holocaust. They don't care about Hitler.
No.
They're just, you know, they've just been taught all these truly false and highly weaponized narratives about this period of our history, and they just accept it. They don't, I mean, it doesn't mean much to them, but that's just what they know, what they've been taught, and they don't really think about it. So could you imagine if we were, rather than watching Schindler's List, you know, in seventh grade when we're in our English class, we're watching, you know, Adolf Hitler, The Greatest Story Never Told, which is clearly much more objective and scholarly than, you know, any of these ridiculous Holocaust films.
Right.
And people would have a much different perspective, a much different outlook on everything, on life in general.
They would. Absolutely. That just is absolutely true. You know, so this is where it's at. You know, it's a tough battle. That's what it is. But I just think that when it comes to revisionism, if everybody in the white activist movement would get on board with it and would, you know, talk in favor of it, it would make a big difference. I think it would, because there's lots of people that, you know, just never mention it, that are influential. I just think it would be good, but obviously it doesn't look like it's going to happen.
I completely agree with you, and I think that, again, more advice to people that kind of go along with Johnson and McDonald and others. You know, look at this from strictly a free speech, freedom of expression, freedom of intellectual inquiry. Think about it just from that perspective. I mean, we should be able to question the Holocaust. We should be able to critically examine it and to entertain other ideas, other perspectives about what really happened. Just that alone, I mean, just from a free speech perspective.
Well,
we should be championing this. You don't have to agree with it, but you should be able to say, hey, look, you know, I think the Holocaust really did happen, but if somebody wants to question it and do research into it, I fully support them in doing that. You know what I mean?
Yeah, my nephew did say, when I just, you know, he looked at all these great arguments and he was like, uh-huh, yeah. But then when I happened to bring up in passing, you know, of the laws against it in Europe, you couldn't talk about it, you go to jail. He said, that's more the most convincing part of it to me. He just
said
that.
Well, it is. It's very, and it totally flies in the face of American, you know, traditions, you know, free speech, the First Amendment. It's totally contrary to all that.
Yeah.
So, I mean, it should
am I breaking up to you?
No.
Is my voice breaking up? Yours is breaking up to me, but maybe it doesn't matter.
Okay. Oh, no, you've been crystal clear actually this entire time.
Okay.
Carolyn, I know we're pretty much at the hour mark and we're going to wrap up here in just a second. I just wanted to really emphasize the fact that this fake narrative, this fake Holocaust narrative, this hysterical, irrational, entirely unfounded, you know, demonization of Hitler and the Nazis. This narrative really is the bedrock of the entire New World Order agenda, the white genocide agenda, which are basically one and the same thing, right? You know, this is so clear. It's so easy to demonstrate that this is the case. There's a couple articles I just wanted to highlight and bring up here real quick. One of which was just published over at the Renegade Tribune, and it's written by a man named John Ware, who has actually contributed to the Barnes Review in the past. And I think the Barnes Review sells some of his books, if I'm not mistaken. He wrote an article called Why the Holocaust Story Was Invented. And he lists a number of reasons that kind of explain, you know, the purpose of the fake Holocaust narrative, what agenda it's advancing. And of course, it's, you know, the establishment of Israel and, you know, the demonization of Germany, etc. There's a number of arguments he makes. It's very, very much worth reading. I don't know if you caught that. I tweeted it out today. I will also link it when I post this.
I read
program.
Something by him that maybe you
it's
sent
good.
To me.
It's good, yeah.
I'm trying to remember it.
And this article, this may be an older article. I'm not sure. I just saw it posted by Kyle Hunt at the Renegade Tribune. So it may be an article that John Weir wrote in the past and he's just reposting it. I know he does that often, but it's worth reading. It's very good.
Does he kind of hold off in certain areas? He's not 100%, or is that just in this thing I read, it seemed like he was doing that for, you know, maybe to be more acceptable or more convincing or something. I don't know. I can't remember. I actually can't remember exactly what it was, but would you say he kind of holds back a little bit or not?
From what I can tell, it doesn't seem like that to me.
Okay.
I mean, maybe he wouldn't be as, you know, as forceful as we are when we talk about these subjects, but no, he seems pretty solid to me.
Mm-hmm.
And this article is very good. It's worth reading. And then also I wrote an article, and you know, I've been harping on this issue for a number of years. And this article goes back to April 26th of 2015. And it's actually on my old blog, my old Blogspot website, which amazingly is still up right now. If you go to it, it's johnfriendsblog.blogspot.com. If you go to it, Google has that, that warning, you know, this is restricted content or controversial content or whatever. And you have to click, I understand, and I will all continue. So they're basically kind of censoring it, but, anyways, you can still find it. And again, I'll link to this article as well. And, this article is titled "Top Jewish Leader Claims Entire Western World Culpable for the Holocaust." And, I just highlighted an article I found in the Allgemeiner, which is a Jewish newspaper. Again, you know, as people that have followed my site know, I highlight Jewish newspapers and just what the Jews actually say, just to expose their agenda and everything that they're about. Cause again, they openly admit these things and say exactly what they're up to. And, this article in particular, I was highlighting, some comments that were made by Ron Lauder, who I believe still is the president of the World Jewish Congress. And, this was, right around the time of the,
whose name did you say?
Ronald Lauder.
Yeah.
Yeah, he's a big time Jew that's been involved in all this stuff for a long time. Right. Anyways, he made a speech. This was at the 70th anniversary of the liberation of Bergen-Belsen. And, he's basically arguing that the entire Western world is essentially responsible for the Holocaust happening because they didn't do enough to help the Jews. And it's just so incredible, some of the statements that these Jews make. You know, he's demonizing the United States for quote unquote shutting its doors to the Jews that were trying to flee Europe, and no one was doing enough to help the poor Jews in Europe, etc. It's just, it's so infuriating, you know, seeing what these Jews say and just how brazen they are that they can have this.
They've got such balls, they're almost like insane. It's almost like they're stupid. Because, you know, they come out with stuff like that. It's not gonna be accepted. And it just reinforces the idea that Jewish deaths are more important than anybody else's. If the whole world has to stop and be responsible for this, what happened here, you know, for this huge number they came up with, the 6 million baloney. But I mean, it just doesn't, but sometimes they're talking to Jews, and they don't think the rest of us are going to be paying any attention.
Yeah, well, so
I don't
true.
See how
and
the
most
Jews
people,
would fault would like that either, you know.
Well, and that's the thing. Most people don't ever, you know, sit down and read Jewish newspapers and Jewish news outlets, which is why I try to highlight them and say, hey, look, these Jews are saying this, not me. You can call me an anti-Semite and a neo-Nazi and everything else, but all I'm doing is quoting Jews themselves, okay? You know,
to make the Jews so important that to say that the whole world is, or the whole, all, even to say all Europe and all Europeans are responsible for what happened to them. And then what? What does he say is supposed to be done about it?
Well, unlimited money, unlimited sympathy, unlimited just acquiescence to this Jewish agenda to genocide our race.
Well, I think it's pass laws against anti-Semitism.
Right.
I think that's what they're after.
Yep, exactly.
You know, and there's nothing worse than that, to say, oh, you know, it's illegal. You're going to go to jail if you express anything that we consider anti-Semitic. And they've got a whole, they're working out what anti-Semitism is, and there's a whole list of stuff. I mean, it's all kinds of stuff. It includes criticizing Israel in various ways. And so, you know, it just puts them totally outside of anybody's control of any way, in any way, shape, or form. They can't be harmed. Then nothing can happen to them in any way. So they're not even responsible for obeying laws or whatever. So this, they're just showing that they really do want extraordinary privileges.
Privilege. They talk about white privilege all the time. It's really Jewish privilege and other minorities that they've elevated and used as weapons against our race. Yeah, no doubt. I mean, it's again, it's very clear if you just read what Jews have to say and listen to what they have to say. But
I think sometimes, you know, we're at war. That's one thing that Hitler recognized, and people blame him for it. Say, oh, he shouldn't have. But you know that they were. This was a war, and he couldn't evade it. You know, you have to go ahead and do it. And that's what we're at war with these Jews, and we can't say, oh, well, let's hope we can all get along. Let's hope that we can have some of them will be on our side. What, 5 or 6 of them?
Exactly. Exactly.
You know, it's just aversion for having to confront things. And of course, for war, you know, for getting serious, it's no fun. It's terrible. Of course we'd like to, evade it, but, sometimes you can't because you just, you know, going to be done in. Yep. By it. Mm-hmm. And that's probably one argument for what Hitler finally did about the Jews in Germany. He went about it, you know, in such a mild way in the beginning, just helping them out, you know, and working with the Zionists who wanted to go somewhere else anyway. And I don't know, you know, it just it built up because of Jews from around the world who didn't want that happening.
Yeah. Yeah, again, that's what's so incredible about when you really have a good understanding of what of revisionism and, you know, all the research that's been done to actually demonstrate that the Germans were not interested in killing Jews at all. They were interested in preserving their lives because they wanted to use their labor in some of these labor camps. It's like, again, it's like the total opposite of what we've been told, but again, the whole World War II narrative is essentially the exact opposite of what we've been told. But I wanted to also highlight one other article that I actually cite in this article that I mentioned. That's on my blog. You can find what I'm about to read there. And again, I'll link this when I post this program. There was an article written by a man named Ian Kagedon, I think is how you pronounce it. He was the former national director of B'nai B'rith in Canada. And he wrote a very, very revealing op-ed in the Toronto Star back in 1991. And the title of it is, get this, Carolyn, I'm sure you've heard of this. Memory of the Holocaust Central to New World Order. That's literally the title of the article, or of the op-ed. And in it, central to the New World Order, right? I mean, this is the title of the article. It's incredible. And he argues here, quote, the Holocaust stands as Western civilization's greatest failure. It was a natural outcome of centuries of racism and of anti-Semitism. To deny the Holocaust is to deny racism's capacity to undercut our civilization's basic values, and to destroy democracy. Achieving our quest of a new world order depends on our learning the Holocaust's lessons. And what are the lessons of the Holocaust? I mean, again, here, this proves my point. The fake Holocaust narrative is literally the linchpin of the entire new world order agenda. Which is simply a Jewish plot to enslave the world politically, economically, and culturally, destroying all genuine national and racial distinctions in the process. And the lessons of the Holocaust, which of course include tolerance, diversity, anti-racism, multiculturalism, the lessons of the Holocaust are specifically designed to erode, delegitimize, and ultimately destroy any form of white racial identity and to justify multiculturalism and massive non-white immigration into the West and to end all criticism of Jews and the Jewish state of Israel and to equate it with anti-Semitism and hate speech. That's what this is all about. I mean, how could we avoid this, Carolyn? There's no
way. Well, he makes it very clear, doesn't he? You know, that, and that's a horrible picture. Total enslavement. You're gonna be programmed with this stuff and you're gonna believe it or you're on the outs. You're somebody who's bad, who's can't exist in our societies. So you probably have to, go into some bad place or whatever. This is the kind of thing you have to fight, but these people will say, oh, that's just that one guy. Nobody will ever fall for all that stuff. Well, look at how much the world has fallen for now. I guess they could fall for the rest of it if the media continues to be so controlled. And then I don't want to bring this up because I don't want to take up any more time, but just to say real quickly, then there's Trump who is like standing against that, but he doesn't have the power to overcome it. We all have to overcome it. We all have to do it. We have to say, God, this is, we have to stop this. And that's why people like this is probably what I was going to say and I couldn't remember, but it's just this, that's what people like McDonald and Johnson, are getting in the way of. They're actually preventing, they're actually helping the Jews in what they're doing. They need to be told this. This needs to be pushed in their face, actually. Rather than say, oh, well, we don't want to say anything bad about them. We have to support them.
Yeah, I mean, I completely agree with you. I mean, I'd be willing to discuss this with any of them and, make my opinions very clear. And not just opinions. I mean, how could you
avoid
it?
Well, I wish we could. And, John, here's an idea. Somebody was talking about that they'd like to have the guy over at, just when I want to think of something, I'm in a hurry, then I can't, but, Mark Weber, okay. Mark Weber, both Johnson got his ideas from Mark Weber, Mark Weber helped him, or maybe didn't mean to send him that direction altogether, but they got him from there, and they think that Mark Weber and David Irving support, give them some support. And McDonald, I believe, too, knows Mark Weber quite well, and they get those ideas from Mark Weber. And yet, I just don't think Mark Weber is so afraid of this as they are. And we could get a conversation with Mark Weber. At one time, Mark Weber wanted to talk on the phone with me and discuss all these things, and I wouldn't do it because I was so in disagreement with him and didn't think he was, he was just going to try to make me see it his way. But I would talk to him now, but I would rather talk to him in public on a public debate, public forum, not necessarily debate, and ask him some questions. I don't know if he'd be willing to do that or not, but it just occurs to me that he might be more willing than McDonald or Johnson would be.
Carolyn, I'm going to see if I can make that happen because I actually know Mark Weber. I'll see what I can do on that front. Boy, that would be very, very interesting to do that. Yeah. Well, I'll see what I can do and I'll certainly be in touch. We're well past the hour now, but that's okay. Let's go ahead and wrap up. I just wanted to conclude by saying, I think from my perspective, which I think I could defend very well, objectively speaking, Hitler was in fact the greatest white leader in modern history. That's very clear to me. I think we do need to rehabilitate his image, and I think we've done a good job at doing that over the course of the past, say 10 years or whatever. Pro-white ideas and perspectives will always, 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 always be tied to Hitler, to the Nazis, to the Holocaust. There's no reason to avoid it or to cower in fear about it. We are right, and we have the evidence and the proof to demonstrate that we're right. And, you know, this is something we need to tackle head on. And if you don't want to, if you disagree with me, don't counter-signal it. Just avoid it, step over it, whatever you got to do. But don't accept this Jewish nonsense about gas chambers and Jews were murdered and this and that. It's all bullshit. Everything the Jews have to say about the Holocaust is utter bullshit, designed specifically to advance Jewish interests and to delegitimize white racial interests. That is so clear, it's so obvious, we should not even be debating this at this point. That's all I got to say, Carrie. Right. Go ahead.
Well, I agree with you, John. Good for you.
Thank you. Well, this has been fun, Carolyn. I'll go ahead and post this up tonight, and I'll see if I can get Mark Weber to talk to us. That'd be very interesting.
Good. Okay. Well, it's been fun for me too, and so I hope the listeners enjoy it.
All right.
Thanks, John.
Okay. Thank you very much. I will talk to you real soon.
Good.
All right. Good night.